Good morning. Welcome to Way Too Early, the show that always wears clean socks. I'm Jonathan Lemire on this Friday, September 24th. We'll start with the news, and we've got a lot to get to. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection subpoenaed four of former President Donald Trump's closest allies. Former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, former Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications Dan Scavino, former White House Advisor Steve Bannon, and former Pentagon Chief of Staff Kash Patel were issued the first subpoenas by the group yesterday. The committee says it is seeking information about Trump's actions leading up to and during the riot and demands the men turn over relative documents by October 7th. They are also ordered to submit to depositions the following week. According to the subpoenas, Meadows and Scavino were in contact with the organizers of the rally that preceded the violence, and Meadows took numerous steps to undermine the election results leading up to January 6th. Scavino also allegedly met with Trump on January 5th to discuss ways to persuade members of Congress against certifying Joe Biden's victory. In Bannon's case, the committee says he attended a January 5th meeting at a D.C. hotel to discuss plans to overturn the election results. That same day, he told listeners on his podcast, quote, all hell is going to break loose tomorrow. And Patel was allegedly in constant contact with Meadows on January 6th and took part in discussions with senior Pentagon officials regarding Capitol security. Bannon, Meadows, and Scavino did not immediately respond to requests for comment, while Patel issued a statement that reads in part, quote, I will continue to tell the truth to the American people about the events of January 6th. And in a statement, the former president said the requests were part of a partisan exercise and suggested he would assert executive privilege in an attempt to block them. Meanwhile, the current White House is reportedly leaning toward releasing more information to Congress about what former President Trump and his aides were doing on January 6th. Two people familiar with the discussions tell the Washington Post that given the gravity of the events on that day, President Biden plans to err on the side of disclosure and grant requests from the House Select Committee. In response, Trump says he will cite executive privilege to block the requests, though many legal experts say that is an uphill battle. This comes as the House panel says it has already received thousands of documents from all seven government agencies it requested information from. The National Archives has also sent two tranches of documents to Trump for review, a process required by law before the information can be turned over to Congress. Nearly a year after the 2020 election, Texas has launched an audit to review the vote count in that state at the request of former President Trump. Just hours after a letter was made public by the former president's team yesterday, pushing Governor Greg Abbott to launch an audit, the Texas Secretary of State's office announced it had begun reviews in the state's four largest counties. Let's remember, Trump won Texas, and despite carrying the state by 6 points, Trump wrote in, quote, wrote in part, quote, let's get to the bottom of the 2020 presidential election scam. The former president is also taking aim at two of his most loyal Republican allies in the Senate for not going along with his claims of election fraud. In a statement on Wednesday, Trump said that Utah Senator Mike Lee and South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham should be, quote, ashamed of themselves for not putting up the fight necessary to win. With friends like that. This, after a new book from journalists Bob Woodward and Robert Costa claims the senators personally vetted Trump's allegations of fraud and were unmoved. Joining us now to talk about all of this, congressional reporter for Politico, Nicholas Wu. Nicholas, good morning. Thank you so much for being there. Let's just give us a state of play right here. How big of a deal are these subpoenas? What sort of message is it sending to the former president and those close to him?
It's a very big deal. I mean, what these subpoenas show is quite how fast the Select Committee is trying to move. Chair Benny Thompson has set this roughly spring goal for them to wrap up their investigation. And Democrats are showing that they really learned from what happened during their very first impeachment inquiry against former President Donald Trump, where he stonewalled a lot of these requests to get people to appear voluntarily and produce documents to committees investigating his call with Ukrainian leaders. Whereas now they're moving very quickly to subpoenas and ramping up the investigation and going right at Trump's inner circle to try to figure out exactly what happened. And like you said, who knew what and when they knew it.
So we have seen Trump allies previously dodge subpoenas, but that was when the former president was still in office. Now that he's not in power any longer, is there more of a chance we actually see these aides, these four significant aides, testify before Congress?
Absolutely. I mean, the Biden Justice Department has indicated that they will be more supportive of people coming to testify before the congressional committees and their investigations. And it certainly helps now that many of these officials are now former officials. So they're not, the process here is a little bit different. And the questions of privilege are much different than they would be if they actually were still serving in the White House, where they could be potentially shielded by these claims of executive privilege.
So Trump, of course, is obviously no longer in power, but he certainly holds great sway over the Republican Party. What do we think, this is a two-part question for you, what efforts could Republicans take to block this, to try to prevent this from happening, this testimony, the subpoenas and so on? But also, in terms of the documents that President Biden is thinking of releasing, what could we learn from there?
Well, first, there's not a whole lot that congressional Republicans can actually do to prevent the Select Committee from issuing these subpoenas and holding these depositions. I mean, congressional Republicans all but pulled out of participating in the Select Committee. And so they don't necessarily have the votes, nor can they actually, take part in actual committee proceedings to try to disrupt or delay or otherwise stand in the way of what they're doing. Now, as for all these documents, I mean, this was part of a huge sweeping request that the Select Committee issued several weeks ago of these big tranches of documents between the White House and any number of different executive agencies and individuals that the Select Committee saw as relevant to its investigation. And so this could shed light on everything from who at the White House knew about, say, the permitting process for the rallies right before the January 6th insurrection, to who exactly the White House was talking to, which is something that we still don't know about from that day, or for that matter, what exactly the former president was doing during these gaps of time on January 6th, where, there's little in the public record other than what we've learned from reporting and, what the president has said himself.
Right. Certainly we know from reporting that the president, didn't do much to intervene that day, that he was off in his private dining room off the Oval Office, kind of watching the events sort of transfixed, and at times almost seemed to be heartened by the displays of support from a mob, which, of course, then descended into violence. Politico's Nicholas Wu, thank you so much for being here. Despite objections from some progressives, the House passed a standalone bill yesterday to fund Israel's Iron Dome missile defense system. The House overwhelmingly approved the $1 billion in new spending by a 420-9 vote. Democrats initially intended to include the funding in legislation this week to fund the government, passed September 30th, but removed it after objections from some caucus members. Though the majority of Democrats supported funding the system, designed to intercept and destroy short-range rockets fired into Israel, some, including Michigan's Rashida Tlaib, were against it. Congresswoman Tlaib, a daughter of Palestinian immigrant parents, called Israel a, quote, apartheid regime, and pointed to its military action against Gaza as reason not to fund the defense system. The U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti has resigned over what he calls the inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport Haitian migrants. It comes as the White House now says there will no longer be border control agents on horseback. NBC News correspondent Morgan Chesky has more from Del Rio, Texas.
More than 4,000 Haitian migrants still packed under this bridge, surviving on so little for more than a week. While back in Haiti, some who have been deported speaking out. One of them, Fedner Paulina, apologizing to the American people, but saying he and his family hope to make the journey yet again. The rising deportations sparking the U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti to resign in protest. Career diplomat Daniel Foote slamming the Biden administration's, quote, inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of migrants. Meantime, the White House, under fire over these images of Border Patrol agents on horseback, announcing horses will no longer be used in Del Rio. And new questions over where many of the 15,000 migrants who were under that bridge have gone. The Department of Homeland Security announcing 1,400 migrants have been deported, and 3,200 are in Border Patrol custody. But still no details on how many migrants were released into the United States. DHS officials have told NBC News that number's in the thousands.
They had an idea that life would be better for them here in America.
So many of the migrants released to wait for asylum hearings coming to Tiffany Burrow's nonprofit shelter.
This time last year, how many people would you help a week?
25.
And today?
In the last 3 days, over 1,000.
Now, her concern isn't running out of supplies, but attention.
Is that the numbers will go down the media attraction of it all will disappear, and then we'll be hit with another wave.
This problem never goes away for you.
Right.
Our thanks to NBC's Morgan Chesky for that report. Elsewhere in Texas, abortion providers in that state are asking the Supreme Court to rapidly review their challenge to the state's restrictive law banning abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy and allowing private citizens to sue those involved. Earlier this month, the court declined to block the law in a 5-4 ruling, citing the complex procedural questions it presented. Since then, providers have turned away most patients seeking abortions. Now, opponents are asking the Supreme Court to take up the case while it is still pending before the 5th U.S. Circuit of Appeals by employing a rare procedure that would allow the issue to leapfrog the appeals court. Meanwhile, police in Tennessee are searching for answers after a gunman opened fire inside a grocery store in Collierville yesterday, killing one person and injuring at least 13 others. Authorities responded to reports of an active shooter at 1:30 p.m. inside a Kroger store in a bustling commercial area of the Memphis suburb. Officers rushed the store, helping injured victims and escorting employees out of hiding. The suspect, who has not been identified, was found dead from what authorities said they believe was a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The victims were transported to local hospitals while police searched for a motive. Last night, officers were seen searching an apartment near the shooting scene, but have not yet confirmed.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
Confirmed if it is the home of the suspect. Time now for sports and the kickoff of week 3 of the NFL regular season to Houston and the Texans hosting the Panthers on Thursday Night Football. Carolina quarterback Sam Darnold rushed for a pair of touchdowns to go along with 304 passing yards as the top-ranked Carolina defense held Houston to just 42 yards on the ground, and the Panthers beat the Texans 24-9. But it is a costly win for the surprising Panthers and also may hurt some of your fantasy football teams. Star running back Christian McCaffrey exited last night's game in the second quarter with a strained hamstring. Ouch. The severity of the non-contact injury is still unclear. Turning now to Major League Baseball's push to the playoffs. We begin in Cleveland, where with a 7-2 win over the Indians in the opener of a split doubleheader yesterday, the Chicago White Sox claimed the American League Central crown. The victory earns the Pale Hose its first division title since 2008 and eliminates Cleveland from postseason contention. Meanwhile, the team at the bottom of that division, the Minnesota Twins, are making things difficult for the Blue Jays in their chase for the American League wildcard game. The Twins beat Toronto 7-2 last night. Consecutive losses dropped the Blue Jays one full game behind the Yankees for the second AL wildcard spot, with the Red Sox holding a 2-game lead atop those wildcard standings. New York has a 3-game series remaining against both of those teams, starting tonight at Fenway Park. Whew. The Yankees series with the Red Sox is the biggest regular season matchup between these two squads in years. I am already nervous. All three teams have 9 games left on their regular season schedules. The fate of the National League West, meanwhile, is arguably in the hands of the San Diego Padres, which snapped a 5-game losing streak with yesterday's walk-off win in extra innings over the division-leading Giants. Meanwhile, in Denver, the Dodgers keep the pressure on San Francisco, cutting the Giants' lead atop the NL West to just 1 game with a 7-5 win against the Rockies. The Padres' performance over the next 10 days will go a long way towards settling the division race. After 4 games against the Braves this weekend, San Diego plays LA and San Francisco 3 times each before the season ends. But the Padres, their own playoff chances are still slim, as they remain 6 games behind the red-hot Cardinals in the race for the second NL wildcard spot. St. Louis extended its win streak to 12 in a row, its longest since 1982, finishing off a 4-game sweep of the Milwaukee Brewers 8-5 yesterday. The Cards hold a 4.5-game lead over the Phillies for the second wildcard spot in the National League. The Phillies, though, still giving chase to the Braves in the National League East. We have a lot to follow here in the final 10 days or so of the regular season. Now, though, it's time for the weather. Let's go to meteorologist Bill Karentz for the forecast. Bill, it rained a whole lot on the East Coast last night and today. Still raining here in New York City. What's the weekend look like here and everywhere else?
Well, this rain that's in New England is going to be slowly moving out. Slowly is the key term. So you may have to wait for your nice weekend, especially areas like Boston may not even be that nice. So let's get into it. You can see behind me all the rain that's on the map, the green and the yellow. That's the heavier stuff now pushing through areas of the Hudson Valley. New York City's just about done. I think you got maybe another hour or two of some light rain, and that should be it for this rainstorm. It'll be a little bit longer there for Hartford and Providence. So this is a slow-moving cold front with some cooler, drier air behind it. Should be a beautiful end of the day for Philadelphia to New York. So as far as this rain system goes, as we go throughout the day today, notice by 8 p.m., still a little bit of rain in the Cape all the way through Boston up to Maine. The issue is that this front kind of stalls along the coast. A little wave of low pressure, a little weak storm comes up the coast. So unfortunately, the forecast has kind of gone downhill for Providence, the Cape, Boston, Portsmouth to Portland, all of my friends in Maine. It's not going to be a great Saturday afternoon and Saturday evening. It should be just fine. Hudson Valley, New York, Philly, D.C., but just extreme eastern New England. Unfortunately, it looks like your Saturday is going to be wet too. So for today, heaviest rains, Connecticut up to the areas of the Berkshires, and then tomorrow we'll get more rain there, Boston, all the way through up in areas of Maine. The rest of the country is like, what rain? It is dry, it is sunny, it is fall, it is warm, it is nice. From the southeast all the way through the middle of the country, looking really great. The west coast, no complaints whatsoever. Even Phoenix has cooled off slightly. And then as we head into your weekend, there's that rain in Maine and also down into Boston on Saturday. Much of the country is dry and pretty warm for this time of year. And then as we head into Sunday, we'll just label that gorgeous. What a beautiful day it's going to be in areas from the Mid-Atlantic, the Ohio Valley, the Northeast, that cool, crisp fall air. The humidity is pretty much very low, so you know it doesn't feel like summer. But areas in the middle of the country, still warmer than they'd like, Jonathan, with temperatures in the 90s. So where's the Yankee-Red Sox series? Is that Fenway?
I was going exactly there. Tie these two segments together, Bill. This series is in Fenway. They play tonight. It's tomorrow late afternoon around 4 o'clock and then Sunday night. What do we think? Are they going to get these games in?
They should be able to get the games in, but it's going to be wet. It's not going to be dry. I mean, maybe, you know, I think the Saturday afternoon game could be most at risk. Maybe they'll have to do a doubleheader on Sunday.
Which would only add to my stress levels. Thank you, Bill Cairns. The rest of the forecast looks pretty good, though. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is planning on getting Senate Republicans on record. He's setting up a vote on the short-term government spending bill and debt limit extension that the House passed earlier this week. Schumer's goal is to test Minority Leader Mitch McConnell's resolve. The vote will force Republicans to cast their ballots against funding the government just days before a shutdown and vote against raising the debt ceiling just weeks before the nation defaults.
Every single member of this chamber is going to go on record as to whether they support keeping the government open and averting a default, or support shutting us down and careening our country towards a first ever default. But if they vote no, the Republican Party will be solidifying itself as the party of default.
Democratic leaders also say they have a deal on how to pay for their reconciliation package. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer announced yesterday they worked with the White House to find several ways to pay for the spending bill that right now sits at $3.5 trillion.
The White House, the House, and the Senate have reached agreement on a framework that will pay for any final negotiated agreement. So the revenue side of this, we have an agreement on. Okay? Thank you. It's a framework, an agreement of a framework.
The deal includes a series of tax increases for high earners, including stock buybacks and capital gains. But that deal is not solidified yet. The Washington Post reports House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Richard Neal told reporters that Democrats continue to haggle over several issues, including new carbon taxes, which have not yet been resolved. Even by Thursday afternoon, many Democrats in the House and Senate said they had not even seen details of this so-called tax framework, sparking a mix of confusion and frustration. This also comes as the White House tries to get all Democrats on board with President Biden's two-part agenda, the infrastructure program and the reconciliations bill. As my colleagues and I report in the Associated Press today, Biden himself has stepped into the breach to personally try to bridge the divide between the party's moderates and Democrats. His pitch, at its heart, this is too important to fail, and that the consequences would be dire for Democrats. Could one single lawmaker stand as the reason for failure of the agenda of a president of their own party? And if these bills are defeated, how can they ask voters to give them a power again in next year's midterms? The White House has also notified government agencies to prepare for a potential government shutdown. This would be the first shutdown of government facilities since the start of the pandemic. The Washington Post reports administration officials stress the request is in line with traditional procedures 7 days ahead of a shutdown and not a commentary on the likelihood, or lack thereof, of a congressional deal. The government will shut down if Congress doesn't pass legislation by the end of the month. Joining us now, NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent Leanne Caldwell. Good morning, Leanne. Let's start with that. We only have one Republican so far who has publicly said they would vote for the government spending and debt ceiling bill. Are other Republican senators feeling the pressure of that vote on Monday? And right now, in your estimation, how likely is it the government could shut down a week from today?
Good morning, Jonathan. That one Republican is Senator Kennedy of Louisiana. He tells me that disaster aid, which is attached to that short-term government funding bill and the suspension of the debt limit, is just too critical for his state of Louisiana. As for other Republicans, including Senator Cassidy, who might join Senator Kennedy, who's also from Louisiana, to vote for it, but they are far from the 10 Republicans necessary in order for this to pass. And the other Republicans aren't feeling that much pressure. They are extremely united at this point with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell in saying that this is up to the Democrats to do. So is the government going to shut down? Well, it's really unclear, but I will say there is not one Democrat who wants this government to shut down, because President Biden ran on promising a government that functions. This would be the exact opposite of it. But they are careening extremely close to this deadline. I don't see how they get out of it unless they punt until perhaps closer to the actual deadline of the debt, when they need to pass the debt ceiling, until it's supposed to be mid to late October. What they could do is they could pass a clean short-term government funding bill for just 2 to 3 weeks, just to give them a little bit more time. But that doesn't solve the problem. That just prolongs it, Jonathan.
Well, certainly kicking the can down the road is a hallmark of Congress. And certainly, yeah, though, it would any extra time would be vital, especially during a global pandemic. Switching gears, we just played it. Democratic leaders say they have a deal on how to pay for reconciliation. But details were, shall we say, scarce. And it certainly seems like they won't have it done by the Monday deadline. Give us your assessment of the state of play. And do we think Speaker Pelosi still puts up infrastructure for a vote on Monday?
Okay, state of play on this $3.5 trillion bill. They walk in and they announce a framework on how to pay for this piece of legislation. Well, a framework is not the details. Every Democrat agrees that corporate tax rate should be increased, but not every Democrat agrees on by how much. So the details are critical here. And also a deal between the Speaker Pelosi and Leader Schumer and the chairs of the relevant committees is a lot different than a deal with all of the rank and file members, namely Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who has the biggest concerns with this big piece of legislation. That is who they need a deal with on how to pay for it, on what to spend it on. And also missing from this agreement of a framework is the price tag, how much of this is paid for. They would not say that this is still a $3.5 trillion bill or if it's going to be $2 trillion. I asked Speaker Pelosi yesterday, and she refused to say the number. So they are still very, very far off, but they are trying to give the illusion of progress so that they can try to keep their party united, or try to get their party united, I should say. And Speaker Pelosi yesterday also would not commit to holding that vote on Monday on the bipartisan infrastructure bill. She has to try to figure out how to deal with the progressives who are furious that the reconciliation bill is not done, that are still demanding a vote on that reconciliation bill before the bipartisan bill. And there's not a lot of trust between the different factions of the party that everyone is eventually going to come together. So no one wants to be left hanging out to dry. And this is one of the biggest challenges I have ever seen Speaker Pelosi in, Jonathan.
I don't want to use the cliche Democrats in disarray, but boy, they got a lot of work to do. NBC's Leanne Caldwell, thank you so much.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Please try to have a good weekend. Advisors to the CDC voted yesterday to endorse booster shots for older and high-risk Americans, opening a major new phase in the U.S. vaccination drive against COVID-19. The advisory panel says seniors ages 65 and up and other medically vulnerable Americans can get a booster dose of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine 6 months after their second dose. The advisors stopped short of a full endorsement for other groups of at-risk individuals, instead recommending that they may choose to get the booster shot if they feel they need it, with consultation with their physician. Joining us now, White House Deputy Press Secretary Chris Marr. Chris, good morning. Thank you for being here so early today. Let's start right there. A lot to get to, but let's start with that CDC recommendation. It says boosters for older adults and those at risk, signs off on that. But we also heard from CDC Director Rochelle Walensky overnight, who endorsed booster shots for frontline workers such as healthcare workers and teachers. Obviously, the White House is in favor of getting booster shots out to as many people as they can. Give us the latest on the state of play there, but also, what response do you have to the criticism from some that say that there's been a lot of mixed messaging when it comes to boosters?
Yeah, well, this is good news. This means that millions of Americans across the country can get booster shots starting as early as this weekend. People 65 and older, people at high risk. That means teachers, first responders, healthcare workers. And so this is a huge step forward for our booster program. This is exactly what President Biden was talking about weeks ago. It's why we started to prepare and get ready and have conversations with states, with pharmacies, making sure that everybody was ready on day one to start putting those booster shots in arms. So we see it as a really good, positive step forward as we try to get people safely vaccinated and booster shots in arms.
So, Chris, this has been, shall we say, an eventful week in terms of foreign policy when it comes to this president. We, of course, had the kerfuffle over the submarine deal with France and Australia, with the French, of course, making their displeasure known. The president gave his first address to the UN General Assembly while in office. And then today, he's hosting the first ever in-person Quad Summit. That's with the leaders of Australia, India, and Japan. Can you walk us through what the administration is hoping to gain from this meeting and tell us about the focus on China?
Yeah, well, since day one, since President Biden came into office, the Indo-Pacific has been a focus of ours. Prime Minister of Japan was the first leader to visit the White House. We had a virtual summit with the members of the Quad, Australia and India and Japan, in March, and now they'll be at the White House in person. I think you can expect their conversation to go over a host of issues. I think cybersecurity and, as we just mentioned, the global pandemic and tackling that, climate crisis, increasing competitiveness, and relations in the Indo-Pacific. I think, you know, President Biden's message earlier this week at the United Nations was one of working with our allies and coming together in a diplomatic way to tackle some of the biggest challenges facing our world right now. And that's what you're going to hear from him later today.
And do we think, staying on foreign policy, give us a sense of the phone call with the French President Macron and an update as to when the two of those leaders may meet?
Well, they committed to getting together later this year, and I expect that meeting to happen. You know, it was a very good, positive phone call between two allies. You know, the president told President Macron on the phone that he could have done a better job of communicating around the AUKUS deal. And the two reiterated their respect and admiration for one another, and the fact that we're allies with France. And one particular situation is not going to impact that. They resolve to continue to work together to communicate better going forward, and I expect that's what you'll see between us and the French.
Chris, let's shift to the domestic front. Is the we've been detailing all morning about all the Congress is tackling right now. Is the White House still hopeful that the Congress can get a spending bill passed and increase the debt ceiling before next Thursday? And what sort of involvement will we see from the president? Will President Biden himself interject himself to try to get a deal done?
Well, the president's been very involved in negotiations on the Hill in a variety of fronts. Obviously, a shutdown would be costly. It would have a tremendous impact on the American people. And a default would be catastrophic. And so, a bill has passed the House, and we hope that the Senate will take that up. Republicans need to match their rhetoric. And if they don't want to support a shutdown, if they don't want to support defaulting and threatening our full faith and credit, then they should vote for the bill that's going to be in front of them next week.
And this comes, of course, against the backdrop of the president and Democrats trying to get his agenda done and hashing out the details of this reconciliation bill.
I can't hear you, Jonathan.
Oh, we've lost Chris Marr's audio, but we appreciate him being here. White House Deputy Press Secretary Chris Marr, thanks for getting up. Come back soon. We'll fix that. Earlier in the show, we asked, why are you awake? Buddy writes, I'm awake to see the cute pet photos that people send in. Well, this one's for you, buddy. Julia shares this photo. Traveling for the first time in 18 months and woke up to see how this cutie is doing at the dog sitter. That is an adorable picture. Jean's up doing some hand quilting. And Michelle says she's up early decorating the house to surprise my daughter because today is her 8th birthday. Happy birthday to Michelle's daughter. 8. That's fun.
Hey everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.